You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my webpage at dr-history.com for over 440 true stories of the Old West. Also, now available on Amazon, my first book, a historical fiction based on true events entitled Coal Miner to Cowboy. The story of a young man born in England in 1850. He wants to be a cowboy and makes his way to America, travels from New Orleans to Independence on a steamboat, hires on as a teamster to Santa Fe, then on a cattle drive to Bozeman, Montana. He also rides shotgun on a stagecoach. He travels with a wagon train, and on his two-year journey, he meets some famous people and keeps a journal of his adventures. The book contains a lot of the true stories from my podcast and is now available on Amazon. Visit my webpage for a link to Amazon for the book, Coal Miner to Cowboy. Howdy, folks. Dr. History here with another story from the Old West. You know, we've talked about the Transcontinental Railroad quite a few times, but we're going to talk about what happened after it was built. We're going to talk about the passengers, rich and poor. So in May of 1869, 5 days after the joining of the rails at Promontory, the first Transcontinental Railroad announced the inauguration of regular passenger service. Once a day, westbound passengers would assemble at Omaha, Nebraska, and board the Pacific Express for Sacramento. And once a day, from Sacramento to the Atlantic Express, would head east on a run of almost 2,000 miles to Omaha. Now, this moment had been long coming, and there's a newspaper guy that wrote his impression. Here's what he said. Quote, "A journey over the plains was a formidable undertaking that required great patience and endurance. Now all has changed. The shriek of the locomotive wakes the echoes of the slopes along the Sierras, through the canyons of the Wasatch and the Black Hills, and his steady puffing is heard as he creeps along the mountainsides. The 6 months' journey is reduced to less than a week. The prairie schooner has passed away and is replaced by the railway coach with all its modern comforts." So, let's talk about that, comfort and speed. These were the two things that no traveler could resist. In 1870, the first full year of operation, nearly 150,000 passengers rode the line that stretched between Omaha and Sacramento. A dozen years later, this number on the route alone soared to almost a million, and this huge traveling population came to form the people of the West. These were the men and women who lived there or visited. Now, some were merely passing through on their way to somewhere else. Now, at the top of the heap were the excursionists and just plain rich folk who rode first class. In 1870, for a fare of $100 between Omaha and Sacramento, the railroad added a certain splendor to the comfort and speed of their journey. First class passengers could ride in these really nice, luxurious cars on fine plush seats that for a modest extra fee could be converted into a snug bed at night. They had such amenities as steam heating, fresh linen daily, and fancy furnishings, and they were served by porters and fatherly conductors who catered to their wishes and whims. For an extra charge of about $4 a day, a first-class passenger in 1870 could take the weekly Pacific Hotel Express. So this is a once-a-week train that offered dining on board. Unless they rode this special train, first and second class passengers alike took their meals on the run at stops along the way. On the Hotel Express trains, the level of food and service was equal to that of the best restaurants of the day, and the trip from Missouri to the Pacific could be actually kind of a restful four-day vacation. Now, I kind of look at this as cruises on ocean ships that we have today. So second-class passengers riding in day coaches had a little different time of it. They moved with the speed of the express, but enjoyed a small measure of the comfort and no splendor at all. Their coaches were upholstered, but they slept in their seats, if they slept at all. For the complete Omaha to Sacramento trip, they paid $80, and they felt like that was fair. Now, the reason was simple. Most of them were not making the complete run. Therefore, not paying the fare for it, the $100, they felt okay. Day coaches were the place for what they called the way or short-haul passengers. So these were the cowhands, the farmers, the miners, hunters, and Indians who made up the permanent population of the West. So typically, they rode maybe a few miles or maybe a few hundred miles down the line. So they weren't going all the way through. So according to one account, no less than 230 stations, most of them in tank towns and whistle stops, dotted the long western route. And from the beginning, trips between them exceeded the through passenger traffic. So there were more people just going part way, what they call the short haul passengers, than the ones that were going all the way through from start to finish, from Omaha to California. By the early 1880s, short-haul travelers outnumbered the long-hauls 6-1. Now, the day coach riders invariably fascinated visitors from eastern states and foreign countries. A lot of times they were the first and sometimes the last real Westerners these visitors ever saw. And they carried with them kind of the romantic, the exotic, the frontier that kind of amazed all the rest of the world. There was a novelist who was riding west in 1876, and here's how he described them. Quote, "They are not elegant, carefully dressed gentlemen, but bearded and mustached individuals dressed in ragged garments, carrying dirty bundles and with revolvers stuck in their belts. Their talk is loud and stormy and filled with profanity. Clouds of tobacco smoke rise to the ceilings of the coaches. Doors slam as they are opened and closed by strong hands." References to the Sioux and Pawnee Indian tribes inhabiting Nebraska and the Dakotas are frequently heard in the conversation. So I think this guy was maybe a little intimidated, maybe even a little bit afraid of the people he was riding with. Now, while the day coach passengers generally represented the real West, the third and lowest class of passengers stood for a West that was still growing. Typically, they were immigrants, outward bound to settle the vast empty lands owned by the railroads and the federal government from eastern and midwestern states, and then increasingly from the countries of the western and northern Europe. The immigrants came in search of land or wealth or simply a life more bearable than the one they had left behind. But their first glimpse of their new lives might have been a little discouraging. Consider this. If you were in England, where in Wales, Scotland, Ireland, where there was a lot of rain, lush green forests and fields, and then you head out west, all of a sudden you're seeing sagebrush and cactus and desert and sand, you might be a little discouraged. Now, the immigrants paid about $40 for a transcontinental trip, and this was the lowest fare, but it also had the worst accommodations. The cars were fitted with rows of narrow wooden benches and were often coupled to freight cars, and they were constantly being shunted aside to make way for the express trains going past much faster. Thus, the westward trip from Omaha, which took 4 to 4.5 days, might last 9 or 10 or 12 days for the immigrants. And every one of those days had hours of boredom and discomfort, but the immigrants endured the journey because they had to. And think of this. I mean, would you rather go by wagon train and spend several months through hot, dusty, dirty weather and danger? So this was obviously the choice of transportation. Now, first-class passengers, by contrast, took their trips just for pleasure, like I said, like a cruise ship. Almost as soon as the rails were joined at Promontory, no man of the world considered himself well-traveled until he went across America in the steam cars. And since this was a kind of an exclusive clientele, this was made more extravagant by a guy you're going to recognize, George Mortimer Pullman. Now, he was a builder of railroad cars who'd long been recognized the profit potential in providing these really nice comforts for those who could afford it. Now, as early as 1864 in Chicago, Pullman had developed the two most significant and lasting contributions to comfortable day and night accommodations: a hinged upper berth, well upholstered, that could be folded against the ceiling of the car, and hinged seats and seat backs that could be flattened for night travel. By the time transcontinental railroading became a reality, he was making himself the unchallengeable lord of restful travel. And the long Western train trips provided an opportunity for his special brand of luxury. From the start, he was able to lease to the rail lines like Southern Pacific, Union Pacific, these cars that were fully equipped and staffed. So they would just add these luxury cars onto their regular train cars. But the sleeping car represented only part of George Pullman's contribution. His parlor cars, picture this, folks, plush upholstery, rich hangings, and hand-carved inlaid paneling, and his magnificent dining cars, in which first-class passengers ate meals prepared by, of course, Pullman chefs and served by Pullman waiters, offered a measure of high living that was unheard of until then. Now, Pullman named his first dining car the Delmonico after a famous gourmet restaurant in New York City, and he set appropriately high standards in his food. For a holiday feast in the West, a Pullman staff was capable of turning out a 12-course dinner equal to that of the finest big city restaurants of the day. Now, everyday meals were not quite as good, of course, but almost all the first-class passengers, including the ladies, boasted about gaining 5 or 10 pounds aboard a hotel express on a special one-month round trip between Cincinnati and San Francisco. So, again, kind of like a cruise ship. The dishes regularly provided passengers on these special trains included things like blue wing teal, antelope steak, roast beef, boiled ham and tongue, oh, that sounds good, broiled chicken, corn on the cob, fresh fruit, hot rolls, cornbread, and everywhere in the Rockies, fresh trout. But until the 1880s, when dining cars became available on regular express trains, most passengers who traveled by rail out west took their meals at stations along the way. So the meals were adequate, but not much of a variety. One lady said you couldn't really tell the difference between breakfast, dinner, and lunch. And another guy said it was like having a delicious chicken stew for every meal. Another traveler, he was offered a meal of freshly shot plover. And like you, I'm wondering what was plover. Upon being told that plover was a game bird, he refused the dish on the grounds that a winged animal, too stupid to fly away from such a desolate place, was unfit for human food. Well, the first-class passengers had plenty of alternatives to his own comfortable seat. For one thing, he had the complete freedom of the whole train, and he usually would kind of walk up and down through the second-class passenger trains to observe life inside the Pullman, to kind of, I don't know, see what, kind of inspect his other humble fellow passengers were putting up with. But in 1877, a luxurious railroad junket to the West was led by the millionaire newspaper publisher Frank Leslie. Now, he wasn't satisfied with just a really nice first-class Pullman car. He built his own private custom hotel car. He was accompanied by sketch artists, photographers, and a pair of star reporters. And during the trip, one reporter described another car of the same train, a first-class car, but one well below the standards of the custom Leslie train car. So, folks, that's kind of the story about the travelers that traveled in the beginning in the nice Pullman cars down to the immigrants who basically sat up the whole time. But again, the alternative was to go across by wagon trains, horses, mules, whatever. And there were probably still some that still did that. But for the most part, everybody, a lot of them mostly, traveled by train. So we'll see you next week.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.